Not everyone, however, was here yesterday. And so I must tell you a story, something that was experienced yesterday here. It was really exciting. It went like this. A group of slaves called Apiru, we translate that Hebrews, found themselves oppressed under the Pharaoh and then found that something wonderful happened. Listen carefully, because the people here yesterday who experienced this are going to tell their story, and those of you who, living in the land of Canaan, have come out of curiosity to see what this band, this mixed company of former slaves are about to hear their story. And that story is an invitation to you to join us in building a new community. Deuteronomy 26. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down into Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, and there he became a nation great, mighty, and populous. And the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us and laid upon us hard bondage. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with great terror, with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now that's where we are. We're between two worlds, the world of the Pharaoh and this land here with milk and honey. What are we going to do with it? We are not fond of the oppression from which we came, but already we've grumbled to God that we'd like to return there, because there are flesh pots there, and out here all we've got to eat is manna. Yuck. And manna is a good symbol of freedom. You know, it's not always that palatable. Is it better than those flesh pots? Well, you've asked to return there, and yet your leader suggests that you should sojourn yet a while in the wilderness. One of you yesterday said that there's something at stake. You don't want to go back there because you value your freedom. It's one of the greatest gifts that God could possibly give to you. But then I pressed you and asked, but how are you going to preserve that freedom? And the best you could answer is, we've got to work at it. Well, that's true. And today we're going to have to address very seriously how we can work at it. Now, for those of you who are new and you don't know whether you want to join us yet, let me describe briefly the two worlds that we're caught between. Here's the world of the Pharaoh. It's well ordered. Everything is taken care of for you. You see, you're a slave at the very bottom of a pyramid, and you're a slave forever. You don't need to worry. Your world is structured for you. Because of this religious cult which supports your society, there is a divine realm up here, and it defines life and all structure on all levels, including the human. The only way that divine life, ma'at, force, order, can come into your society is through the divine Pharaoh. The king is divine. And so emanating from the divine realm through the Pharaoh are the structures of the society. And they locate you as a Hebrew right down here at the bottom, without freedom, but with food to eat. However, you have a memory of that wandering Aramean, Abraham, and of a different kind of promise to that patriarch. And that promise is that in heaven there is a different kind of God, who wills not that you be slaves forever, but that you be led from a promise into the freedom of your own land and an opportunity to worship God as God ought to be worshipped, and to build a community. And so you have experienced that God enters human life not through a divine Pharaoh, in other words, not from the top on through the various layers, not in a hierarchical fashion, but God enters life from the bottom. The true God is a God not filtering down through a divine king, but entering society at its lowest strata and leading out from that oppressive context the oppressed people into a new society. And that's where we stand, somewhere like that, right there in the wilderness. What will we build? Here is the ordered society. We're in the liminal state between that and freedom, threatening yet promising. We're going to have to work at it, one of you said. Now, those of you, again, who were not here yesterday may now leave if you want to go back to the flesh pots. They're in that building right up there. But if you want to stay, join the project. All we've got to work with is the example of this liberator God who doesn't want a stratified society, who wants to live humanely within the context of the new society. And what we have to work with as we work at this is the example of that God. In Exodus 15, the earliest song in the Bible, recording the impressions of this released people, we found out that this God had several characteristics. And a new triangle began to emerge. This God was majestic in holiness, was righteous in a stringent, ordering manner, and was compassionate in reaching out to those excluded. And with that triangle, we are invited to try to work out this society which will preserve our freedom. We find ourselves responding in two ways. Already in Exodus 15, we notice that that was a response and a very distinct one. What was Israel's initial response to her primal experience of deliverance? Joy, fear, and you gather joy and fear up into one act, and it is an act of
praise,
worship. Right. So the first response to the primal experience is a response of worship of the holy, majestic, righteous, compassionate God. And that is the cornerstone of Hebrew community. Hebrew community simply isn't without worship, without acknowledgement of the sole sovereignty of the one true God. Anything else is a sham. Israel does not give us an example of society predicated simply on an ideal of humaneness, as if the human family can be friendly and at peace without worship. Why is that? It's not a popular teaching today. A lot of people fear the transcendent dimension because it's repressive. To acknowledge a sovereign God reminds them of their oppression. Among some feminist circles, not the ones I've encountered here, but among some feminist circles, the idea of a sovereign God is regarded as an ally of their repression in the society. And there's good reason for that suspicion. You see, the God of the Bible has been misused by an awful lot of males through an awful lot of history to repress women. And so their response is, get rid of the transcendent God. Israel's experience was very different. Israel was repressed, was oppressed. And she found that her only hope under heaven was that there was a sovereign God, because that meant a court of appeal for slaves, for the oppressed. They did not desire a leveling of the universe so that everybody was friends. Because even friends become enemies and stab another in the back, and then there's nowhere to turn. But in Israel's universe, there was one sovereign which relativized all other powers. And because that sovereign was not an oppressive patriarch or matriarch, but rather the righteous, compassionate God, the universe was a very hopeful one for the oppressed. It promised release. So that is a first characteristic then of this response, a response of worship of this ineffable one. Now we're going to spend most of our time today in working out this new community in this liminal stage between the flesh pots and whatever may lie out there before us by looking at the second response. Besides worship, what is necessary in a community? Yes?
Memory.
Okay. We must retell our story if we are to know whom we are. And okay, here we are now, worshiping God, retelling the story, and what can we draw forth from that in order to make ours a viable community? Anything else lacking? So we're worshiping and telling our story, and in the meantime, X is forgetting the story and demanding more of the world's goods than Y. Okay, rules and laws, you know, law and order. We don't sometimes like the word, but society does not exist without guidelines. So that's the, I'm going to include memory with worship, because Israel worshiped by retelling her story. So besides worship, recollecting the story, I'm going to call the second response Torah. Torah is translated in the New Testament nomos, which is translated in English as law, and a lot is lost through that translation process. Because we think of law as that which is laid on us, it's oppressive, it's a burden. In Israel, Torah, etymologically, is derived from the verb yara. That doesn't surprise you too much. And yara means to point. And it is God's pointing out to a people how it is that they may walk faithfully and in the protection of the order of shalom, the order of peace, God's order. And so you have Israel at this liminal stage already, trying to gather together institutions, laws, structures, which will preserve freedom, which will safeguard against their falling back into slavery or their becoming slaves of other people, under the example of the deliverer God. And I thought that perhaps the best way to go about viewing this movement from birth to organization was to look at the earliest collection of Torah in the Bible. And that is in Exodus 20, verses 21 through chapter 23:19, the Book of the Covenant. It was fully developed before Kings arrived. It was written around 1150. If Israel came out of Egypt under Moses in 1250, this thing was formed 100 years later. And it is an interesting document because it's very Baroque. It's not well formed. It includes various types of laws and specifically two different types. First of all, we have a major group called case laws. And they are found in 21:1 through 22:17. They are drawn directly from Israel's environment, from the Canaanites, the Mesopotamians. They are an indication that as soon as the people got in the land, they knew that they needed structure, order, and they borrowed from their neighbors. And so you read that if a bull gores a pregnant woman, there shall be such and such a payment. Now they are changed a little from their neighbors, because in Mesopotamian law you'd find three cases under that specific law. If the woman is the wife of a free person, the payment shall be such and so. If she is of a nobility, they shall be greater. If she is of a slave, they shall be not. In Israel, that was leveled, but that's a rather minor change. You will also find in chapter 21:1 laws legislating slavery. Slavery is accepted. It was all over in the environment, and Israel couldn't quite conceive of society without slavery. But they did add an element, namely that in the seventh year, slaves should be released from their slavery. But oops, again, in continuity with the environment, only the male slaves. The women shall remain slaves unless the slave master tires of the woman and says, get lost, similar to Islamic law. That's the kind of laws we find in the case law section. They're interesting, I think, primarily in seeing that Israel, at that early liminal stage, knew that there was a need to structure society, and she drew on these neighboring laws. Now, I'm much more intrigued, though, in the other set of laws. There is no name that we can derive from comparative religious studies,
because they're not found in other religious systems of the ancient world. They're found in 20, 22 through 26, and then again in 22, 18 through 23, 19. In other words, they become an envelope around the case laws. You'll see why. We'll call them Yahwistic laws. Yahweh is the name of the God that these people encountered in the delivery from Egypt. And let's see what these laws are like. And now, similar to our reading Exodus 15, I'd like you, both you who came out of Egypt and you who adhered, who joined with the rest of us in the land of Canaan, I'd like you now to reread your laws and imagine yourself back there in that liminal stage trying to define community as a community assuring freedom under one sole God. Now, Vi, do you have a Bible? Would you please read for us one of the laws which we have discovered under God's guidance to order this new community of ours in chapter 23 of Exodus, verse 9. Wait just a minute as people locate that. 23, verse 9.
You come out of the presence of strangers. You know the heart of a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt.
Okay, now a stranger is ger in Hebrew. That means an alien. That means one without protection of the state, without citizens' rights. Why a law regarding the stranger? What category are we dealing with here in a society? In Germany, it would be a Gastwerke, you know, one of these Turks or something, who do not have full citizen rights. Why identify that category, do you think, for a special law?
Memory of their own experience.
Okay. Now that is the second question already. Well, but also it's the first question. But they are, pardon me?
So the universality of God, that God is not only for Israel.
That's already there. Well, you're beyond the simple notion I had to start with here. It's a vulnerable class in society. Here is a class that is vulnerable to exploitation and wrong. And so in these case laws, in an uncanny manner, you have Israel searching, the community searching the environment and locating those groups which are most vulnerable to oppression. Okay, now we come to you. What is the motivational force which Israel identifies for addressing this problem?
Sense of community with these people.
And what you just said a minute ago, why do they sense community? Why is there empathy for this group of aliens?
They know what it feels like.
Right, exactly. This is a people now defining this new society from the bottom on up. It's not the king saying, this is what it means to be righteous, this is my royal decree. These are former slaves saying, in my heart, I know what it is to suffer. And therefore, we will not, under God, oppress any vulnerable member of our society. By the way, you know the heart. That's nefesh in Hebrew. And it's the essential being. It's the center of one's being. You know that center. You know that essential being of the alien. You were one. And of course, then unsaid, and God ministered to you in that state. Okay, so those are motive clauses. We see the structure of that law then. An apodictic command. No fudging around with cases. Simply an austere divine command predicated on a motivation clause. And the motivation clause is rooted in God's antecedent grace. Grace, response. Now, let's see. I wonder, Fritzi, if you would read for us next 22 to 24.
You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you do afflict them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will burn, and I will kill you with a sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless.
Now, widow and orphan, what category? describe it.
Helpless.
Helpless. And much more so than today, of course. This is a patriarchal society, and the protection of a woman is in her husband's house. And then after that, in her progeny, her children's homes. She's drawn in upon the death of her husband. Now here you have a widow and an orphan. Understandably, orphans not of marriageable age. Really, a category ripe for exploitation and finally slavery. These types usually lapsed into slavery in the ancient Near East. You have to remember that these are cultures whose human power was slavery. This is really what made these ancient cultures viable. So here was a pool of resources for slavery. Widow and orphan addressed. And again, you find here the apodictic command simply laid on you. Do not afflict these. Do not make slaves of them. Do not oppress them. And then the motivational clause. What happens if you do? There is a court of appeal, isn't there? There is a God who will not let that go unnoticed. In other words, this is a society, this is a community placed directly under the all-seeing eye of God. That is a God who has proven God's self in the Exodus to be righteous, that is, has an absolute standard which is unbending and compassionate, who encompasses all within the protection of this community. That God will see. And this, by the way, and that's why I think it's utterly necessary to always combine righteousness with compassion. This is not a pampering love. I ran across a book a couple of years ago describing a very difficult passage of a married couple through the discovery of cancer of the wife to her death. And it was called Severe Mercy. And this is the type of compassion which we experience here. It's a righteous compassion. It's not pampering. If in this community people oppress the vulnerable, the widow and the orphan, God responds in righteous wrath. And the tables will be turned. The oppressor will find, well, he won't find, but his wife and his children will find themselves widows, widow and orphans. Now, finally, a third example. Let's have one of the new Apiru from Canaan read. Who is new today and didn't leave for the flesh pots? Okay, Robert. You're an old Apiru. I've seen you around a few days. Go ahead. I'd like you to read 22, 25 to 27.
If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be to him as a creditor, and you shall not exact interest from him. If ever you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, you shall restore it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering, it is his mantle for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate.
I'm so glad that we do have other elements that have come in. You notice the slight difference in accent. His Hebrew has a little bit of a Canaanite twang to it. Now, I wonder, Robert, do you see a pattern emerging here? Is this similar? What is the group that's singled out here?
The poor.
The poor. And we don't need to talk too much, pardon me?
The ones who don't have as much.
That's for sure. And the next step after poverty in such a society would be? I mean, once you, the poor, you're driven into poverty beyond a certain line, you become a slave. And so that is what's being addressed again here. And once you become a slave, you're back in Egypt. That is to say, your basic humanity has been denied you. So there is something very much at stake here. And now I like how concrete this becomes. Specifically, you shall not be to him as a creditor. You shall not exact interest. You know, interest, as we've seen with a vengeance in the last 2 years, becomes for many a trap. You've read about people who are like addicts with their credit cards. And, you know, they have 5 credit cards that they're circulating freely, and then finally the indebtedness becomes such that they can't really pay it, so they what do? They,
Reborrow.
They refinance under another lump policy, and the payments become so great that they exceed their income. Now, that is what interest can do.
On a talk show the other night, you can't sleep, you know, you turn these things on. One young fellow was $45,000 in debt.
Yeah.
He had gotten cards from 40 different companies and always paid the previous one with the next one.
Right.
And he was asking, how do I get out of this?
Well, was he referred to this professor in Pennsylvania who just put different names on all of them and it worked for about 5 years? Did you read about that? But at any rate, Israel had another answer to that. Don't tempt these people, you know. No, I mean, interest is a very... I don't want to get into a contemporary problem. You know, I think there's a real argument that interest is that which exceeds inflation. A lender should at least be able to keep his principal. I think that could be argued biblically. But Israel here, at least in principle, is really addressing this problem of re-enslavement of former slaves. And then look how concrete it becomes. And this is so biblical. If there is lending that goes on, and you take as security the garment of your neighbor, you shall make sure that it gets back to that neighbor before the sun goes down. Because that poor person has nothing else to keep warm in. And if that does not happen and that poor individual cries to God, God will hear because God is compassionate. Boy, that's the motive clause. That is the source of Israel's notion of community. A righteous, compassionate God. A God who will punish and a God who will hear. And those are two sides of the same divine coin. I also am intrigued by two other laws here in this group. In chapter 23, verse 2 and 3, we read, "You shall not follow a multitude to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a suit, turning aside after a multitude." In other words, your standard of righteousness is just as impartial as God. You're not influenced by the masses so as to pervert justice. "Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in a suit." You're not to favor the poor man, you know, not to blind yourself to the right, to the cause of the rich man in favor of the poor man. You know, that's interesting. As soon as that's said, however, you could just see some rich man grabbing onto that and exploiting it. You go to verse 6 and you read, "You shall not pervert the justice due to the poor in his suit." That's the kind of his or her pronoun in Hebrew. So there you have a very interesting way of building society. Do you see then a relationship between this triangular concept of the God encountered in the Exodus and the community that's built? What will be the characteristics of this new community of released slaves?
Compassion.
Righteousness. Now, we mentioned law and order, and that is usually seen as a quality of society which is partial in favor of those that have. There's righteousness. Now, how does compassion relate to that? Depends how you define compassion. One of the best words, the central words in Hebrew for that is chesed, and it's covenant fidelity. It's that particular care of especially the vulnerable members by the divine suzerain. And I didn't do this intentionally, I was just drawing quickly, but this opening in the triangle could become, I think, a parable. Righteousness is the standard derived from God's holiness, which defines right and wrong in the society, and without that we have total chaos. But if you have righteousness alone, there is a tendency for those who are empowered to use that standard to exploit, to minimize the rights of those without power.
in the courts, in business transactions, and the like. And so this compassionate, this ideal of compassion, maintains an opening in the society so that all those who are excluded by the standard will be encompassed and drawn back in. And I think that is the polarity, the creative polarity of Hebrew society between a standard and an openness and embracing of all elements, excluded and included. But they don't hang together too easily in the average society. And so there is a third characteristic ingredient in Hebrew society. We called it the cornerstone earlier on. And it is related to God's majesty and holiness. And what would that characteristic be seen from the human side? We mentioned it before as the first response.
Worship.
And I think that this is a message that believing people in a society are responsible to communicate. Compassion and righteousness as the essential ingredients of a humane society cannot be held together save through the example of the divine, compassionate, righteous deliverer. I don't think it's in human nature to hold these together. I think it's only as we derive our nature from God's nature can we order a society which is at the same time righteous and compassionate. Now, I'm going to pause at this moment because perhaps questions or observations are in your minds. Yes?
One of the, I'm not sure if the passage I read some time ago was the passage in a different version than we just talked about on usury thing, or if it's somewhere else in the Old Testament. The point of that passage in the version I was reading suggested that usury was not to be charged to one's fellow countrymen, which said that to go beyond that was all right. Mm-hmm. It truly says something about community too, doesn't it?
Thank you. That's like Fritzi's remark yesterday about the tendency for this new slave ideal to be parochialized, held in, you know, close to the chest and not shared. You are right. And you're thinking of Leviticus, I believe here, Levitical legislation, which outlaws usury only in relation to a fellow Hebrew. And that does raise some questions about the process that we're engaged in. We call this Holy Scripture. It is God's Word. In what sense? In chapter 21, one following, we had the legislation regarding slaves. It's quite evident to me that the Bible can be best understood in terms of this twofold movement, again, divine initiative, gracious, seeking to save, and human response. And they're both genuine. The one is pure grace and compassion and righteousness because it's divine. The other is a compromising and faltering compassion and righteousness because it's the human response. And the Bible is a record of that relationship. We receive it, however, not directly from the divine initiative, but through the human response. And hence, we have imperfect responses. And only a long process of Israel grasping, struggling to grasp that essential nature of God. And my, are we still struggling to grasp it? Let me give you an example. First of all, I would see this process under the analogy of the vessel and the wine. What Israel experienced in liberation from Egyptian captivity was the new wine. Marvelous, beyond any earlier experience. But as she tried to preserve in memory, I'm mixing the analogies now, metaphors, but as she tried to preserve that wine, all she had was the old wineskins. That is to say, the forms and structures of the cultures around her. And so she tried to concretize that experience in institutional and societal forms through laws such as we've been examining. And in part, those forms were unbroken in continuity with the oppressive societies around her. So they included slave legislation and usury, but forbidding usury, but only of the individual, because that's how society's operated. But look what happens. The dynamic, nevertheless, retains its potency. And after a while, it exposes the contradiction between the contents and the form, the vessels containing it. Give you an example. We mentioned that in Exodus 21, the Book of the Covenant that we're studying, you allowed for the release of male slaves, but not female. In Deuteronomy, which was the second version of that law, which came about 500 years later, you released both the male and the female. Then you come to the next version of the law, which is the Levitical one, which this gentleman just referred to. And in slave laws there, you forbid slavery, male or female, altogether, but only of Hebrews. It's completely analogous to usury. A foreign slave, a Canaanite, that's okay. Then you come to 1850, not BC now, but of our common era, and you find a civil war being fought out as that dynamic still attempts to attack inadequate vessels, huh? So there you see how it is an ongoing process that God is engaged in here. God on God's side remains faithful. Humans remain faltering. And believe me, it's not all uphill, is it? But as the New Orthodox theologians saw, it is up and down. I mean, are we closer to God's kingdom now than Moses was or than the disciples were? Hardly. Now, I just wanted to... were there other questions? That was such a good one. I should... Yes,
Robert. I just wanted to comment on the relationship between righteousness and compassion.
Yeah.
The fact that that's in the Sermon on the Mount as well, that the blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied, as immediately followed by blessed are the merciful.
Yeah, oh, interesting. Yeah, I hadn't seen that juxtaposition. What I had noticed... Just to anticipate what some of you may not experience, because this is going to run for a couple of weeks, and I'm convinced that this triangle does. It is a paradigm of the whole development of community on into the Christian church. Jesus is struggling with the Pharisees constantly, as you recall. And the Pharisees have embodied righteousness as that strict standard which excludes. Because they begin to define it, right? And in Matthew 23:23, you find Jesus' response to that. And whoever's found it, why don't you read it for us?
Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you tithe mint and dill and cumin, have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel.
Thank you. that's really the passion, I think, that is coming through there. And Jack here draws attention to the law, the Torah. And Jesus' attempt to identify the weightier matters, in other words, the heart again, the essential, the essence of that Torah. And it's not these superficial structures of society, practices, rites. What is it?
Slightly different words, but justice,
mercy,
faith.
And I think that is Jesus' reply, and I do think that he is drawing very deeply on Israel's earliest experience of what it means to be a people of God. Now, what other structures result from this kind of community building? I'm not going to deal textually here because time doesn't allow us to dig all of this out as minors. Out of the biblical text itself, but let me just tell you a couple of other institution structures that develop. We have seen here now that slavery is attacked, the job's not finished, and we have special attention given to the various vulnerable classes in the society in the attempt to structure an egalitarian society, avoiding the stratigraphy, the stratification of the earlier Egyptian society. Another institution that developed, I noticed some of you, when I use the Hebrew word, nodding, knowing Hebrew, so I'll name it for you, Nechala, the Nechala, which is hard to translate, but it's very concrete, and we can certainly describe it. The Nechala is translated often inheritance. Better, I suppose, would be patrimony. We are dealing with a patriarchal society. Simply put, it is this: each family, as an economic unit, is granted a portion of land, a garden plot, sufficient to the sustenance of that family. However, that institution is predicated on this principle: no one has ownership, entitlement to land. The land in total is owned by God. Here's this idea of the sole sovereignty of God. And what that means is that, well, no one owns it, but no one can take it away. In other words, once it is granted to a family, it is granted in perpetuity. And that assures the economic viability of every family in Israel. How many of you knew of that custom in the Bible? Yeah, okay. How many didn't? How many find that new? You know, that's very typical of our understanding of the Bible. It comes in the law sections. And so we don't teach anything about the Nechala. What we've done with the Torah is, through the eyes of Augustine, we see it strictly as that which is a harsh taskmaster driving us to the grace of Christ. I think Calvin was a little better off than Luther at this point. I'm not going to sing hymns of praise of Luther. I mean, I owe my understanding of the relationship of the individual to God through Luther. But Luther was a little short-sighted when it came to the communal dimensions of faith, I think. And Calvin, I think, was better off in identifying different functions of the law. And one was to be a light unto the feet of the redeemed. And that is really the original Hebrew meaning of Torah, you know, as a pointer. And Nechala is a radical, marvelous, far-sighted concept which tries to address this problem of the tendency of every society to demote certain members at the promotion of others. In other words, promote certain members at the cost of others. Separate the divide. You know, that's constantly a problem. And so here, we have an institution developing of entitlement to a right to the use of land for every individual, every family in Israel. Now, another concept which grew out of this in the law of manumission of slaves and forbidding usury and the like is the concept of the Jubilee. We saw the mini Jubilee in the 7th year. But in the 49th year, what happened? It was an all-encompassing return of the land to its original God-intended purity. So if anyone did lose their Nechala, it would be restored to them. If anyone did fall into poverty and slavery, their debts would be forgiven and they would be reinstated in the society on their Nechala. It developed very far. If anyone had fallen to illness, it was understood that healing would occur. In other words, the order of Shalom would be restored in the 49th year. Yes.
Was that still operational in the day of Jesus?
You know, as so much, we're defining, and thanks for the little word of realism again, because it does raise the question, what is the relationship between this notion of community, which we see unfolding really as God's revelation to God's people? What is the relationship between that and the real life lived by these people? You know, if we don't ask that, we can begin feeling awfully miserable. We're beyond the pale. These people have this wonderful notion. They're primitive. They're almost cavemen. They're capable of that kind of sharing. And here we are. Look at the miserable wretch we are in this society. No, it was the same then. And it's a question of whether the Jubilee was ever actually enforced. Certainly wasn't laid on. It became an ideal. in a number of my books, I've drawn attention to the tension between the vision of the religious community and the pragmatic realities they live in. The Jubilee is a glimpse of that vision, and the real life involves the constant attempts of the community to translate that vision into the real structures of the society. Israel did engage in this early period very seriously in attempting that translation, and I tend to see that early period as very consistent in that translation. But we're going to trace, tomorrow in fact, we're going to come to Kings and find how they constantly compromised that vision until they almost brought Israel back to Egypt, in effect. Yeah.
In Jesus' ordination sermon, he spoke of the year of the Lord. Author I read some time ago suggested that he was really suggesting that was the Jubilee year.
Now the ordination sermon was in Luke chapter 5, I think, and the book you read was 4, and the book you read was John Yoder, The Politics of Jesus. A marvelous book which everyone should, I think, read. And Jesus there in chapter 4, you said 4, right? 4. Was quoting Isaiah 61, 1 through 3. Which is a servant song, and which is a celebration of the Jubilee, which sees the restoration when Jesus, when the Messiah would come, as a restoration of the Jubilee. Jesus' whole ministry was an attempt to get Israel back to that primal moment of deliverance. And, you know, we see the Lord's Supper as a recapitulation of the Passover, and Jesus' life as a recapitulation of the Exodus event. Now made far more profound in getting at the roots of humanity, but constantly in consistency with that pattern of divine initiative and human response in thanksgiving, worship, righteousness, compassion. Thanks for these connections. You see, we're dealing very loosely with my notes, but I can do that because I have a very fine, open Apiru audience here who knows its Bible, its tradition. It's marvelous in its memory, Zechariah, and so that's how free we can be. But the time says we have only 10 more minutes. So let's just give a few more illustrations of this early ideal of community as it's been teased out of the Exodus experience. What we've done is named specific laws, institutions, ingredients in this new communal ideal. This was all summarized in the Decalogue, which probably took its present form. Actually, there are two forms in Deuteronomy 5 and Exodus 20. But basically, it took its form in about the 9th century. It's later than the Book of the Covenant. It's a very polished summary of that protective fence around the people of God. Notice the pattern, though. Let's look at it just briefly. Not only do you know it by heart, but you know Luther's exposition of the commandments, so we can be ever so brief here. But as you look at this Decalogue, what is its primal moment? Where does it begin?
I'm the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt.
Who brought you out of Egypt. Location of the ultimate sovereign authority, the only one worthy of worship, and memory of the antecedent act of grace. And on the basis of that acknowledgement and memory, the structures of the society can be teased out. And they begin with soul worship of God, and then the forbidding of any idolatry, any imaging, any placing of penultimate ideals alongside of this ultimate one, and then of course on through the various structures of that society. So the same pattern, antecedent grace, divine initiative, human response, is the basic pattern that structures the Decalogue. Let me tell you a story and then read a poem as a means of summarizing what we've learned today about Israel's earliest notion of community as people of God. I'll read the story. It's written far better than I could paraphrase it, and it's found in Genesis 38. Better than my reading. Get tired of my voice. Who likes to read here? Okay. And who else likes to read? Okay. Let's see how this divides into paragraphs. We're going to read chapter 38, verses 1 through 26. And so we're going to ask you to read verses 1 through 11. And let's see, what other hands? Let's raise them high, people that like to read. Oh, good. Then, Jack, let's have you read 12 through 19. And then, would you read verses 20 through 23? And one more reader. Would you please read 24 through 26? Go to it.
It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned into a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hirah. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He married her and went in with her, and she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. Again she conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. She was in Chezeb when she bore him, and Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife, and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went into his brother's wife, he spilled the semen on the ground, lest he should give offspring to his brother. And what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, and he slew him also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah my son grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brothers." So Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house.
In course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. And when Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah, to his sheepherders, he and his friend Hirah, and the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she put off her widow's garments and put on a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, for she had covered her face. He went over to her at the road side and said, "Come, let me come in to you." And he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" And he answered, "I will send you a kid from the flock." And she said, "Will you give me a pledge till you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she rose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood.
To receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he could not find her, and he asked the man of the place, "Where is the harlot who was at Enanim by the wayside?" And they said, "No harlot hath been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her." And also the men of the place said, "No harlot has been here." And Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, lest we be laughed at. You see, I sent this kid, and you could not find her."
About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, and moreover, she is with child by harlotry. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, mark, I pray you, whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Then Judah acknowledged them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not lie with her again.
Now you ask, why on earth do I have us read such a story? And the reason is, I think that a good story is much more able to drive home a profound truth than a lot of abstractions. But what are we after here? How does this illustrate the heart of Israel's concept of community, which we have been deriving from Israel's primal experience of release from slavery? I'd like to just discuss it with you, but time is so short. Let me just summarize what I see to be the heart of this story. First of all, Judah is the father of the 12 tribes of Israel, the patriarch par excellence, the patron figure of this society. And he is one who illustrates the heart of Torah at his expense. This is a patriarchal society making fun almost of its saint to drive home a point. What this society is not is a legalistic society which takes its law as an ultimate righteous standard which by virtue of its stringency is allowed to oppress the disenfranchised. It is not that static, heavy use of the law. Tamar challenges the law in that sense. Judah becomes a proponent of such righteousness. Someone commits adultery. Someone deceives, that person is to be burned, according to Judah. Tamar is one who acknowledges only one sovereign, only one authority, only one norm in Israel, and that is the compassionate, righteous God. And on that basis, she is willing to take her cause in her own hands and bring it privately to that God's court of appeal. And so she does all kinds of things that nice girls don't do. And she presses her cause. She doesn't return the pledge, does she, at nightfall? She does seduce someone into an act of sex, and she becomes pregnant, and so she is judged. And as a very clever woman, she brings herself to this austere patriarch, righteous but superficially, and says simply, by the one to whom this signet ring, this staff, and this cord belong, I am with child. That is to say, in this society, every individual is entitled to protection, be she widow, orphan, poor, alien, and Tamar is all of these. She is of a foreign house, she is driven to poverty, and she is a widow without protection. And so she goes to the patriarch and says to him, I've pressed my point. I, under God, deserve protection in this society. Judah, proud, austere, enforcer of the law, gets the point and replies ever so simply and powerful, this woman is more righteous than I. She's grasped the meaning of the law. The law is a dynamic presence in our midst. It is not a formal oppressor of the alien, of the widow, of the poor. And now, after taking seriously the example of that woman, I'd like us to turn in conclusion to 1 Samuel 2 and read aloud together a song of another poor woman, because she captures the essence of this new community. Hannah. Remember, Luke introduces his gospel with this and then follows it with that passage earlier cited. 1 Samuel 2, verses 1 through 1 through 10a. 10b, beginning with "the Lord will judge the ends of the earth," is added later by Kings. Now, that's a higher critical judgment on my part, but I'll defend it if you want privately. We're going to read 1 Samuel 2, verses 1 through the first half of 10. Let's read. My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies, because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy like the Lord. There is none besides thee. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble are in strength. Those who are full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who are hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne seven, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low, he also exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a person prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven.
A few kings among us. I do believe that that captures the heart of Israel's early notion of what it means to be a people of God, related to this one who alone deserves praise, and deriving from that one an example of righteous compassion, which in the first instance locates the poor, the vulnerable, the oppressed, the meek, the peacemakers, and grants to them a special room to carry on their witness to the community and to the world. Now, since we are wretched and broken, we are in that category, and I'm thankful that such is the God revealed to us by early Israel. Yes, sir.
I want to hear that part here, the second half of 10b. Mm-hmm. The way I look at that, it almost sounds like if you add to it, you're going to
hear
the Kings again.
That's right. You've captured exactly what motivated my dropping that. There are many cases of early poems where there has been later editing, and that's exactly what happens there. We'll discuss that tomorrow, because tomorrow we're going to discuss what happens when kingship was reintroduced into Israel. It really is.